The following is a production from the Florida State University's Department of Religion. On Thursday, April 5th, 2012, Liz Wilson, a professor of comparative religion at Miami University, was a guest speaker for the 11th annual Tessa Bartholomew's lecture. The topic of the lecture was The Buddha's Mother as Feminist Conundrum, Exploring the Death of Gautami. This lecture lasts approximately 1 hour and 7 minutes.
Hi everybody, I'm John Clark and I'm chair of the Religion Department. And before we get started today, I want to say something about why we're here this afternoon. The Tessa J. Bartholomew's lecture in religion has been established by the faculty of the Department of Religion at Florida State University in memory of our late colleague, Tessa Bartholomew's, who was born in 1958 and died in 2001, came to Florida State as an assistant professor in 1993 after having graduated from the University of Virginia in 1991 and then serving briefly as faculty at Indiana University, Purdue University in Indianapolis. She was promoted to associate professor with tenure in 1997, and she was promoted to full professor in 2001. While at Florida State, Professor Bartholomew's established a reputation as a leading interpreter of Buddhism through such works as Women Under the Bow Tree, which was published by Cambridge University Press in 1994, Buddhist Fundamentalisms and Minority Identities in Sri Lanka, published by SUNY Press in 1998, and In Defense of Dharma, published by Curzon Press in 2002, as well as through numerous articles and book reviews in scholarly journals. Professor Bartholomew has also received a number of awards for teaching at Florida State University. She served as treasurer for the American Institute of Sri Lanka Studies and is the book review editor for the Journal of Asian Studies. We're happy to be able to gather on this occasion every year to remember her fondly and to learn more about the area in which she taught. So I'm going to pass the microphone, as it stands over there, I suppose, to my colleague, Associate Professor Kathleen Erndl, herself a scholar of South Asian religions, to introduce today's Bartholomew's lecturer.
Thank you. Welcome, everyone, for coming to hear our lecture today. It really is an honor to be here to introduce our speaker today and also to remember our dear friend and treasured colleague, Tessa Bartholomew's, who really was a pioneer in the study of women and Buddhism, as well as issues of Buddhist identity and many other things as well. And we really miss her as a colleague and as a scholar and as a friend. We're very honored to have today with us Liz Wilson, who started out her career. She got her BA at Davidson College in Interdisciplinary Studies in Religion. She got an MA at the University of Chicago Divinity School, where she also received her PhD in History of Religions. She has spent the bulk of her professional career at Miami University, and where she is currently professor in the Department of Comparative Religion, as well as being an affiliate in Women's Studies and also in the Asian American Studies program at Miami University. She has published extensively in the area of Buddhist studies and primarily in pre-modern Indian Buddhism. That is her field. She is the author of a book with the wonderful title, Charming Cadavers. I love that title. Charming Cadavers, Horrific Figurations of the Feminine in Indian Buddhist Hagiographic Literature. Great book, I highly recommend it. She has also edited a volume called The Living and the Dead, Social Dimensions of Death in South Asian Religion. She has published, in addition, numerous journal articles and book chapters, book reviews, etc., and even on a much wider variety of topics, including such topics as modest dress in Islam and many other wide-ranging topics. She's currently working on an edited collection on Buddhism and the family, and also has a strong interest and a possible future topic of Buddhism and masculinities, continuing on from her study of basically male perceptions of women in Buddhism in Charming Cadavers. But she is interested in carrying that study on further. Today she's going to be speaking to us about the Buddha's mother. And as many of you probably know, the Buddha's biological mother died shortly after his birth, and so this Buddha's mother is actually his stepmother, foster mother, whatever. She is a very interesting figure in the history of Buddhism. There are contradictory reports about her, but not only that, contradictory interpretations. So it gives us something to think about in terms of the role of women and the importance of women in early Buddhism and beyond, to later Buddhism as well. And in fact, I'll just share here with you, when I'm the one who did the very artistic flyer for the lecture, and the graphic that I chose was the Wheel of Dharma as a very generic symbol. Because I looked online to see if I could find an image of Mahaprajapati, which is the name of the Buddha's mother, Mahaprajapati's parinirvana, or death. There are many, many images of this for Gautama the Buddha available. However, I could not find a single image of the Gautami, of Mahaprajapati's parinirvana, or death. So that says something as well, and I think we'll hear more about that from our speaker. So the title of her talk is The Buddha's Mother as Feminist Conundrum, Exploring the Death of Gautami. So help me welcome Liz Wilson.
Stepmother, adoptive mother, and mother, because really that's the role that Gotami plays in his life. Among his female relatives, the Buddhist stepmother Gotami stands out as one of the most accomplished. She was the founder and head of the female monastic order, just as her son the Buddha was the founder and head of the male monastic order. She achieved nirvana, the goal of the religious life, just as her son did. And when she finally passed away, when she achieved final nirvana at the end of her life, passing away out of the realm of conditioned existence, she went out in great glory with an awesome display of supernormal powers that made her religious accomplishments stand out very clearly. So in what she achieved in life, Gotami stands as a female counterpart of the Buddha. But as a feminist, I'm interested in the disciplinary power of patriarchal social structures. And what I see in a number of accounts, Indian Buddhist accounts that portray the life of Gotami, are depictions of her choosing a religious life only after it's chosen for her by familial circumstances. There are a number of Indian Buddhist texts that depict Gotami as a woman who waits until all of her family obligations are basically met before she turns to her own needs. So today I'm going to draw mainly on Pali language sources, Indian Buddhist texts composed in the Pali language. And I'm going to draw from a fairly broad time span, from the 1st century BCE to the 5th century of the Common Era. These are texts that, in some cases, have the redaction process begins, say, around the 1st century BCE. It takes a couple of centuries for the final redaction to take place. My reading of these texts will reveal a woman who could control the forces of nature through her wisdom, but who also shows deference to patriarchal authorities. So the conundrum for me as a feminist is to see that both sides are relevant, that both sides hold together to a certain extent, and to hold the two aspects of Gojumi's portrayal together in a reading that shows the two sides together but in tension. And I think that's a productive tension. It shows us Buddhist gender politics at work. In our own society, we constantly negotiate what gender means in different contexts and debate about gender norms of behavior. And Buddhists are no different. Codes of feminine and masculine behavior get reconfigured in different ways by different groups for different purposes. So keeping the two sides of Gotami in tension, I think, helps us to think about gender as a matter of contestation and negotiation. And that's what I see going on in the text that I'll talk about today. So in my comments today, I'm going to focus on Gotami's relationship to various family members, especially her husband and her sons. I'll show places in the textual record that stress her completely flawless performance of conventional gender roles as wife and as mother, roles that would seem to entail subordination to male authority. Part two of the paper focuses on the portrait of Gotami's death as given in the Gotami Abhidhamma, which is a Pali language biography. This text framing of her death is particularly instructive as it stresses both her social location as a female, wife and mother, and the fact that she transcends conventional feminine gender stereotypes. So she's both a deferential woman and a cosmic performance artist whose control over space and time convey very clearly what women can accomplish. If I were to put it in pop culture terms, I would say that this text gives us a Gotami who is both something of femme something of an airbender who has mastery of the universe. For those unfamiliar with her story, let me begin with a little bit of background on Gotami. And in this part one of my paper, I will focus on her decision to leave home as a nun and to take up monastic life. So the Buddhist stepmother is generally known, as Kathleen indicated, in Pali texts as Pajapati or Maha Pajapati, Great Pajapati. But she's known alternatively as Gotami, and this is based on the clan name of her family, the name of the family that she married into. Her son Buddha also bears a similar clan name, Gotama. So this is a feminine version of the same clan name. Gotami and her sister were both married to King Suddhodana in a polygamous marriage. Gotami's sister, named Maya, was Suddhodana's chief wife, and it was she who gave birth to the Buddha. But she died 7 days later, according to traditional narratives. That's a whole story in and of itself that we can talk about with the timing of the death of the Buddha's biological mother. So her sister, Gotami, looked after the child. Even though she herself, Gotami, had just given birth to a son of her own, named Nanda. She had just given birth to the son who was born a few days after the Buddha. So Nanda is the Buddha's younger brother, but only by a few days. Gotami takes the Buddha under her care, and she gives her own son, Nanda, reportedly gives him to wet nurses so that she can assure that the Buddha will survive. So she raises the child as her own in the sense of feeding him, nursing him, and caring for him. She and Suddhodana raised the Buddha together, helped to arrange the Buddha's marriage at the appropriate time, and then she remains at home with her husband after the Buddha goes on his famous quest for awakening, after he leaves home. So as tradition has it, the Buddha achieved awakening sometime in his 30s. As the eldest son, the Buddha was to have succeeded his father as king, but he's kind of out of the line of succession now, having become a renouncer and achieved awakening as a Buddha. Nanda, Gotami's biological son, is next in line. He's next in birth order, so he's the obvious heir apparent. Gotami and Suddhodana are both proceeding with that plan that Nanda was to become the successor to his father Suddhodana. They'd found a bride for Nanda, and they'd arranged for him to be consecrated as king. They'd even scheduled the wedding and the consecration on the same day. Perhaps they were trying to save money on a booking fee or something. In any case, the big event was scheduled, but it was not to be. On that day, instead of getting married and being consecrated as successor to his father, becoming king, Nanda follows another path, and he takes up monastic life. He follows his elder brother into monastic life. So, as some texts have it, instead of completing the work of his father in terms of ruling and being a successor in his political dynasty, he instead joins the clan of the Buddhas and takes on a different identity, goes a different path. It's at this point in Gotami's life that, according to one Pali commentarial source, she chose to go forth from home to seek ordination for herself. A Pali commentary on the Anguttara Nikaya notes that Gotami decided to become a nun at this point after her son Nanda left home as a monk. Now, another commentarial source says that it was the death of her husband, Suddhodana, that led Gotami to form the desire to go forth as a nun. This, for example, in Dhammapala's Paramattha Dipani, which says, "Now it therefore came to pass, while the Buddha was staying at the hall of the gabled house near Vaisali, that King Suddhodana attained arhatship and passed away. Then the idea of renouncing the world came to the great Pajapati." In these Pali accounts that link Gotami's decision to seek ordination as a nun to the departure of her biological son Nanda and the death of her husband, we see possible echoes of a view that's expressed in some Brahmanical texts that a woman is exalted to the extent that she stays under the supervision of male authority figures, such as her father, her husband, and her son. Many of you likely know the passage in the Brahmanical legal treatise that's known in the West as the Laws of Manu. This passage suggests that virtuous females are always under the watchful eye of male guardians. Virtuous women do not exercise independent agency. So the verse in question, Manu Smriti, Book 5, verse 147, states that a woman should never be without a male guardian. When she's a maiden, it will be her father. When she's married, it will be her husband. And if her husband passes away, then that guardian role goes to her son, her eldest son, on down. So her sons take up the role of the husband. So Gotami, at this point in her life, has lost all of her primary male authority figures. Her husband has passed away. Both of her sons have gone the path of renunciation and live away from home. If her sons lived as the early Buddhist literary records suggest, they were wanderers with no fixed abode. They moved from town to town and only stayed a short time in one place. If they lived such a life, the Buddha and Nanda could have been hundreds of miles away from their mother, and really in no position to keep an eye on her. Gotami's decision to seek ordination as a nun comes in the midst of what some Brahmanical authorities would have regarded as a domestic crisis in the domestic sphere. Right? The patriarch of the family is dead. The sons who might have replaced him are far from home. Even her grandson, the Buddha's boy, Rahula, has by this time become a monk. So what is a woman who's very mindful of her familial obligations, a family-minded woman, to do? Should she stay at home, even though she has no sons to look after her there? She might do better to follow her kinsmen and take up their wandering lifestyle, if that would allow her to remain under the supervision of one of the authority figures who is supposed to be keeping an eye on her. If I'm right about the crisis of authority in Gojimi's life, then her decision to go forth from home to homelessness to seek ordination as a nun makes sense in this context. It could be read as an attempt to preserve her virtue as a family-minded woman, a woman who's aware of patriarchal family politics. Now, I think that this interpretation is strengthened by the fact that when you look at the status of the early Indian women's order, women's monastic order vis-a-vis the men's monastic order, they operate a little bit differently. And the women's order has special rules that subordinate women to men in terms of the way that the two organizations are set up as organizations. So many of you know about the 8 special rules that are additional rules that the nuns follow. And there are things that keep monks and nuns from operating as equals in terms of symmetry between their statuses. So for example, women in the nuns' order were to show veneration and respect to men of any age, no matter how long they had been ordained as monks. Whereas men in the men's order, their deference pattern is set up so that seniority in the organization is the basis for deference. So a senior monk who was a 20-year veteran of the organization would not show deference to a junior monk who'd just been ordained for a year or two. But that was not the case with the women. The nuns would need to show deference to monks no matter if the monk had only been ordained for a day. No matter how senior the nun was, she would have to show deference to the monk. So that's one example. There are other examples in terms of the way that the organizations operate. In terms of matters of ordination and penance, the rules for the 8 special rules for the Bhikkhuni Sangha, the women's order, prohibit its operation as an independent body. So when Gotami is shown accepting these 8 special rules as a condition for ordination as a nun, this suggests that she and her nuns will not operate in an autonomous manner. Going forth into the renunciant life of a nun in this way replicates some of the patriarchal structures of the home she left behind. So it's almost as if Gotami never left home, in that she will, if she goes into this monastic organizational structure, she will remain under the jurisdiction of the senior male in her family, the Buddha, who's the head of the male monastic order. So this kind of move would redound to the good of the clan. It would protect the reputation of the family, and this would show Gotami's virtues as a woman who knows her place in the patriarchal family order. That is what I think our two sources are trying to tell us about Gotami when they link her decision to go forth and seek ordination as a nun to the leaving home of her youngest son and to the death of her husband, the loss of her husband. Whether she herself had any such thoughts is really of no concern to me as a scholar. That's not what I'm interested in. I'm not trying to draw a psychological portrait of Gotami. What I'm interested in is what the texts are trying to tell us when they link her decision to these life events involving her family. So I think the texts in question want us to know something about Gotami's family-mindedness. They're eager to present her as a woman who strongly identified with her roles as wife and as mother. The portrait that they draw is of a woman who knows that the reputation of her family may be at stake, and so ordination as a nun is a good choice for her. It safeguards her family's reputation. This interpretation is strengthened by the fact that Gotami is not alone in deciding to seek the life of a nun. She goes with 500 of her kinswomen. They've all, according to the sources, lost in their own lives, they've experienced a loss of male authority. The text report that all of these women have lost their husbands to the monastery. So these 500 women, or 500 kinswomen, are left, in a sense, with the social identity of widows. When a man ordained as a monk or a woman as a nun, the Indian Buddhist literary records suggest that the marriage was terminated as if the spouse had died. The left behind spouse could not force the ordained spouse to come home. Thus, the 500 kinswomen who accompany Gotami into the nun's life have become virtual widows once their husbands ordained as monks. 500 women without husbands pose the problem of the renounced woman or the left behind spouse. This would be an issue for those concerned with family reputation, as I think those who authored our text clearly were. So having this group of kinswomen go off with Gotami to seek ordination underscores this idea of venerating the patriarchal family structure, solving the problem of the left behind or surplus woman, and helping to suggest the idea that these women are staying within the bounds of decent female behavior. Now let me say a little bit about the chronology of the text. In suggesting that those who composed the text I'm using today were anxious about Buddhist women and their place in the family, I'm relying on the insights of Alan Sponberg, who talks about the development of Buddhism in India. And he notes that early on, the period of the historical Buddha and his family, the place of women in the monastic life was clearly a trailblazing place. There was much more of an opportunity for women early on than other traditions had offered. This is true of the Buddhist tradition, this is true of the Jaina tradition as well, that both of them really broke new ground for women, offering opportunities. But with the growth of Buddhist institutions comes the need for steady patronage, and with that comes anxieties over the place of women. So in this time period that we're talking about, Sponberg suggests, some Buddhists begin to advocate policing their women. The community is growing in stature, it's seeking cultural dominance. Early on in the early years, it didn't really matter if these women were operating independently and gallivanting around on their own. It would not have necessarily raised eyebrows, or if eyebrows were raised, it didn't so much matter. Now, some Buddhist communities found themselves in a position where the status of the women was potentially a problem for potential converts, for potential donors. The status of independent-minded women had become a bone of contention. And so some factions advocated minimizing opportunities for women to exercise independence. Sponberg thinks that such groups were responsible for producing the documents that tell us about the 8 special rules, for example, and also documents that tell us that when the Buddha agreed to allow women into monastic life, he predicted that there would be a decline of the Dharma or Dhamma, that this would bring about a shortening of the time when the religion would flourish. So what's happening, according to Sponberg, is that there's kind of a backlash, you could say, and this expansionist Buddhist community is basically engaging in revisionist history. So looking back and making the Buddha look much more fretful about the place of women than he may actually have been, making him look very anxious about the place of women. And so these accounts that stress the subordination of women are probably part of that revisionist history. So Gotami's literary depiction as a woman who waits until her family obligations are met before she acts would seem to be a reflection of the values of this period of growth and increased sensitivity to patriarchal concerns. So turning now to part two, to Gotami's death and her passage in this amazing performance of her final nirvana. Let's look in some detail at how one Pali text underscores her social location as a female while showing us a woman of remarkable achievement. Now, there are versions of Gotami's death in various Asian Buddhist sources, but here I'm going to focus on what's conveyed in the Pali language text, the Gotami Apadana. And this is a biographical text that is found in a collection of narratives that looks at good deeds of the past that explains a person's present life achievements. It's a very interesting text composed in verse with multiple voices. John Walters thinks it may have been performed, that it has a theatrical component, which is a very interesting thing to think about. It was probably composed 4 to 7 centuries after the events that are depicted in it. And in the Gotaniya Abhidhamma, the speeches of various witnesses stress the incredible calmness with which Gotami passes out of the world of conditioned existence and into final nirvana. She's attained the iddhis, the supernormal powers that come with perfect insight. She touches the sun and moon with her hands, then she plunges into the earth as if it were a body of water, and then she walks on water as if it were earth, does all of these amazing things, including the miracle of the twins, which is a miracle that's attributed to the Buddha that he performs frequently in his life, which involves emitting fire from top half of the body and water from the bottom and then switching it, so it's a really amazing display of you could say, airbender powers, mind over matter sorts of powers. Here's John Walter's wonderful translation of verse 81 that shows Gotami's powers of replicating herself as well as powers of unimpeded movement. She was alone, then she was cloned, cloned and then alone. She would appear, then disappear. She walked through walls and through the sky. Gotami orchestrates all kinds of magical displays as she enters her final nirvana. At one point, she even becomes the Hindu god Vishnu, who's well known for his cosmic apparitions. So it's really an awe-inspiring exit, a kind of virtuoso performance. And I suspect that Gotami would win a slap down with any professor of the Hogwarts school, given her talents here. And this display of supernatural powers is framed specifically as a response to those who think that women cannot succeed on the Buddhist path. The Buddha asks his stepmother to display her powers as a demonstration that women can achieve whatever men can achieve. In the text, Gotami proclaims her religious accomplishments in a long series of verses. Then in verse 79, the Buddha says, "Yet there are those fools who doubt that women too can grasp the truth. Gotami, show miracles that they may give up their false views." Gotami in this text also brags about the accomplishments of little girls who get what wise elders within the Buddhist fold and other male religious teachers cannot. In verse 66, she claims, "That state which is not seen by elders, nor by non-Buddhist teachers, is witnessed by some Buddhist girls when they are only 7. That state that she's speaking of is the deathless state, the condition that Gotami saw when she realized nirvana. And her final nirvana is the completion of this state, this vision of existence that transcends death and birth. But this is also a text that stresses Gotami's role as the Buddha's mother and the limitations of that role. In verses 32 and 33, Gotami belittles her performance of the role of a nurturing mother who breastfed the Buddha as a baby. She says that her breast milk perpetuates the cycle of birth and death, while the milk of the religious teaching that she got from her son, as her teacher, liberated her from this cycle and allowed her to achieve the deathless condition of nirvana. So here's what she says. "Blessed one, I nurtured your physical body, but this flawless truth body," Dhamma Tandu is the term here, the body of the teaching of the Dhamma, "this flawless truth body of mine was nurtured by you. I suckled you with mother's milk, which momentarily quenches thirst. From you I drank the milk of the teaching, continually at peace." So the contrast is fairly clear. Gotami gives the Buddha a mortal human body, while he gives her something more lasting, the transcendental gift of the Dhamma that quenches thirst and hunger forever. Gotami lactates, Gotama preaches. What Gotami has to give is an extension of her transient physical body, the milk produced by her breasts. What Gotama has to give is an extension of his unchanging textual body. He gives the milk of the Dhamma, which flows from the eternal body of the teaching. If the Buddha seems to perform the motherly role of lactating his teachings as breast milk, what he gives his students is better than anything that ordinary mothers give. So in this way, GoToMe both identifies herself as female and denigrates her maternal capacities. And in this connection, I'd like to mention the impressive work of Reku Onuma on the theme of the Buddha's debt to his stepmother, the debt that she owes him that he owes her for her nurturing him as a baby. It's an interesting theme that runs through a lot of different texts in Asian Buddhist context. But Onuma studied accounts of the founding of the nun's order, in which the Buddha seems to have been guilted in to admitting his mother as a nun, despite his reservations against his better judgment. But it's guilt over the fact that she raised him, she nurtured him, and gave him her breast milk that is kind of the trump card in these accounts. In the light of the perception that the milk debt, as it's called, imposes a heavy obligation that the Buddha cannot ignore, it's interesting to me that the composers of the GoToMe Abhidhamma put words into GoToMe's mouth that minimize the force of the milk debt. In verse 31, she tells the Buddha that it was nothing what she did for him. She states that even though she mothered him, he actually parented her with his teachings. He is thus her father, her progenitor, even though she was the one who parented him in breastfeeding him. She says, "Blessed one, I am your mother. You are my father, O wise one. Lord, you give the bliss of the Dhamma. Gotama, I'm born from you." So there's this interesting trope of the Buddha as mother, but ultimately it's the Buddha as father that GoToMe stresses here in this passage. And I think that says something about the patriarchal discourse that is sort of the natural default mode for many elite Indian Buddhist thinkers. Now I'll mention that Reku Onuma has a new book coming out, which I highly recommend. It'll be coming out this spring through Oxford University Press, called Ties That Bind Maternal Imagery and Discourse in Indian Buddhism. And she looks at some of the ways that while elite Indian Buddhist authors were much more comfortable with the image of Buddha as father, at a popular level, discourse about the Buddha as mother did circulate and had some traction in places like Sri Lanka and other parts of Southeast Asia. So check out the book. I think it'll be one that's well worth reading. Returning to the Abhidhamma, I'm going to focus now on what the text tells us about the timing of GoToMe's decision to pass away to find Nirvana. In verse 3, she states something that I think is interesting. She says she cannot bear to live on after her male kinsmen die. She anticipates the future passing away of the Buddha, her younger son Nanda, her grandson Rahula, and her nephew named Ananda, as well as that of the Buddha's two chief male disciples. And here's what she says in verse 3. "I can't bear to see the Buddha's final passing, nor that of his two chief disciples, nor Rahula, Ananda, and Nanda." GoToMe's apprehension that the Buddha and others are bound to die shows her understanding of the impermanence of all things and all beings. And in addition, she's right to worry about the Buddha's passing, because in Buddhist circles, the opportunity to see a Buddha in the flesh is thought to be a really precious privilege. So making progress along the path is exponentially easier when you have the example of a living Buddha in front of you. So the prospect of losing such an opportunity naturally would make GoToMe apprehensive. But I wonder if this verse also shows signs of some authorial anxiety over the problem of the surplus woman that I talked about before. Does this verse indicate anxiety about the Buddha's stepmother becoming an unattached, superfluous female? Given the politics referred to above that link her decision to go forth as a nun with the loss of key male authority figures, seems that possibility is worth examining. No doubt you're familiar with the Hindu practice of widows choosing to die, the Hindu practice of widows choosing to die along with their husbands, a custom that's known in the West by the term sati, the epithet for the goodness earned by a wife who immolates herself on her deceased husband's funeral pyre. GoToMe's decision to predecease her male kinsmen could be read as an expression of feminine fears about being bereft of male guardianship, one of the motivations that's sometimes attributed to women who earn the title of sati by going along with their husbands in death. Gojimi's actions might thus be comparable to a specific form of sati, in which a woman whose husband is about to die takes her own life in anticipation of her husband's death, a practice called puruvanamarana. We have some literary evidence that indicates that Buddhists in South Asia were aware of the practice of sati. We have texts redacted in Nepal, similar kind of biographical texts that mention the practice of sati in passing without any sort of comment, suggesting that the custom was nothing unusual. But even without evidence that later Buddhist communities in South Asia knew of the practice of sati, it's abundantly clear that concerns about unmarried women were troubling to Buddhist authors of the early centuries of the Common Era. So Gojimi's decision to predecease her kinsmen could be seen as a logical response to such concerns. So is Gojimi represented here in this text as wanting to predecease her kinsmen in order to protect her reputation, the reputation of her family and clan? At one time I thought that that was clearly the case. But by setting Gojimi's decision in a larger cultural context, I see that this is probably going too far. So in looking at her choice to predecease, to die before the Buddha's passing away, she's actually, as I see it, fitting into a larger cultural context of many South Asian religious figures who choose to exercise control over the moment of death and to die at a moment of their choosing in a way that displays their achievements in life. And that is what I think Gojimi is doing in the Gojimi Apadana. So the sort of pattern of self-chosen death is one that many, many saints in South Asian religious traditions display. Voluntary death is almost an index of sanctity. I would say. It's highly valorized as a sign of a person's attainment. I think this is because many South Asian religious traditions attempt to limit the contingency of death by offering some sort of ritualized means of achieving mastery over the end of life. There's the Jaina practice of salekana, which many of you know about, death through fasting. In the Hindu tradition, there's a wonderful book called Death in Benares that many of you may know by Jonathan Perry that is based on the ethnographies of contemporary Hindus in Varanasi. And he talks about the ideal of many contemporary Hindus being one in which you pass away in full control of your faculties, surrounded by your family, having determined in advance the moment of your death, in other words, showing complete control over the circumstances of dying. Perry mentions one very spiritually accomplished man who his informants mentioned to him who performed intense austerities for 9 months prior to dying, predicted the moment of his death, and then died sitting upright while listening to recitation of Hindu scripture. And as this pious man's body was being cremated, Perry's informants told him, it successively manifested itself in the form of several deities and several famous religious teachers. So that's the kind of self-willed death that is so much valorized in South Asian circles. And certainly Buddhist literature places a very high premium on the idea of self-chosen death. Taking control of one's circumstances and passing away from this world is a theme that is seen in many Indian Buddhist texts. Not only is the decision to terminate life at a moment of one's choosing an act commonly attributed to Buddhas and Buddhist saints, but there are texts that even suggest that every Buddha voluntarily distinguishes the remainder of his allotted lifespan. So no Buddha passes away by what we would call natural death. It's always a matter of determining what is the right time to die and passing away under full control. Many Indian Buddhist narratives emphasize the idea of saints who decide to enter final nirvana upon hearing of the death of the Buddha. Thousands of saints are reported to have entered into complete nirvana upon hearing of the death of the Buddha. One Tibetan source reports that 18,000 saints died on that occasion. typical of those saints who herald the passing away of the Buddha are those who hear about the Buddha and who hasten to be there to die before the Buddha dies or to get there right after the Buddha has died. I'll give you one example of a monk who hurries to be to time his own passing away with that of the Buddha. That's a monk named Subhadra, who provides a nice parallel to Gojami in terms of timing. He reportedly terminated his existence for the same reason that she did. He didn't wish to live to see the Buddha pass away. He had learned of the imminent death of the Buddha. He learned that the Buddha was dying in a dream. He went to the Buddha to ask about the path, and he achieved awakening upon hearing the Buddha's answers to his questions. And he thought to himself, I should not enter final nirvana after the Buddha. He then seated himself in the lotus position before the Buddha and resolved his body into flames, performing his own self-cremation in this way. And so he orchestrated his death to coincide with the Buddha's death. As these examples indicate, Gojami is not alone in responding to the imminent death of the Buddha by orchestrating her own passing away. And she's one of many saints who reportedly made this choice. If the act of passing away into final nirvana is a testimony to what one has achieved, then to die in the presence of a Buddha is a clear statement that one has learned basically everything that the Buddhas have to teach. A helpful analogy would be a dissertation defense for a doctoral student. Is having your advisor testify to what you have achieved as you present your completed dissertation proves that you are an equal, that you can hang up your shingle as a professor. Now, from time to time, a dissertation advisor dies while the student is still at work. That's a situation nobody wants, right? So if this analogy holds, then those saints who time their final nirvana to proceed or coincide with that of the historical Buddha are like those students, those good students who finish their dissertations on time. They orchestrate the ideal demonstration of professional success. On this analogy, Gotami is being depicted as an ideal student. By passing away when she did, Gotami made sure that her advisor was there to certify her achievements. But let's not forget that Gotami is a teacher in her own right. As head of the women's order, she was also the mentor to the nuns under her care. And in the Gotami Abhidhamma, she's not alone in reaching final nirvana. That is to say, she passes away with her 500 fellow nuns. So the Abhidhamma shows Gotami and her nuns passing into final nirvana as a group. It's a group exam, if you will. But Gotami is in the lead here. And the fact that all 500 women achieve final nirvana along with Gotami testifies to her abilities as their teacher. So Gotami's final passing from this world thus sums up a lifetime of achievements. It certifies the attainments of Gotami as a student of her son, but at the same time it certifies her own abilities to lead others to the deathless state of nirvana. So in concluding, let me just return again to the theme of contestation and negotiation over gender norms that I began with. The portraits that I've looked at today present a woman who's every bit as accomplished as her son and other men in the order. But they also show a woman who sometimes takes the reputation of her family into account. If we find different tones, perhaps dissonant tones, in a portrait like that of the Gotami Abhidhamma, it should come as no surprise given the social dynamics of the time period. There were all kinds of stakeholders in this time period in competition with one another. And many of the texts reflect multiple views, different factions with different viewpoints. Some more focused on the ideal of Buddhist women as carriers, sort of banner carriers for patriarchy, and some more focused on what women could achieve, and not so much interested in establishing gender norms of behavior. Although the time period I focused on today may have been particularly contentious, I think it's fairly representative of how gender norms are always open to contestation. It's through such negotiation and contestation that Buddhists, like us, constantly reconfigure what gender means. So I think I'll leave it at that. We have a few minutes for questions. hopefully some conversation.
So please ask your questions, and if you don't mind, if you can just field them. Please. I'll start out with something obvious.
All right.
What about the fact that she would have been over 100 years old by now?
Yes, certainly in the Apadana, she is. She's reported to be 120 years old. But what I find interesting is that there are different chronologies and different notions of how old she is. And there's one rendering that would suggest that she's much younger when she passes away. So it really does become a question of sort of giving up.
Well, the Buddha was 80-something, right?
The standard accounts.
So presumably she was a young woman
yes.
when he was born.
Right. Right.
Younger than 20, maybe?
Yeah, presumably. Yeah.
Presumably.
Yeah.
So we could put her age at maybe about 100.
Right.
If you're thinking about it in that way.
Right.
Which is a pretty ripe old age.
Right. But it is interesting that, you know, the fact that the chronologies do differ. So in the reports of her leaving home to seek ordination as a nun, those that would locate it at the moment of her husband's passing away would make her a much more mature woman. But those who would locate the moment of ordination at the moment when her son Nanda leaves home, that, according to some texts, is about 5 years after the Buddha achieves awakening. So, you know, it's hard to say on what point, in her life and to know which chronology to go by. But clearly, yes, she's a mature woman. With some life experience.
Yeah, because the only thing I would want to say is that not so much that it's noteworthy that she dies before the Buddha, but that she hangs on as long as she does.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Given the fact that she wants to predecease him, but not by too much.
Right. Well, that's an interesting. That's something to think about. Yes, and the theme of those who. Who are around after the passing of the historical Buddha. Those are important people who are able to carry the torch. And there's all kinds of Buddhist lore about saints who basically bank their fires and who live up in mountaintops in a state of suspended animation so that they can, you know, receive the bodhisattva who's going to become the next Buddha and give the bowl and robes of the last Buddha. So they're, in other words, there's a really important role to play for those who can live on and postpone their death. So I hadn't even thought about the whole issue of Gotami being one of those sort of torch carriers. Very interesting. Yes?
I was just remembering Kathleen's comment when she introduced you about not being able to find an image of her, and I just wondered what sort of role she plays in contemporary Buddhist culture, whether the lack or the inability to find an image is related to that, or what you might say about that.
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about the memorialization practices, not just in terms of monumental building, but in terms of rituals and production of writing. And one thing that's interesting is both Mahaprajapati and her sister Maya, there's a great deal of literary production about them, but neither has a stupa, a monumental building that we know of that would have been built for them in India. And in terms of liturgical practice, I think this is something that would be instructive to look in different parts of Asia to see what sort of memory different communities had of the Buddha's stepmother and the Buddha's birth mother, because I'm sure that those sorts of collective memorials are done in very different ways by different communities. And in the contemporary case, there's a great deal of interest in Mahaprajapati and her role as a female Buddha. So liturgically, she's being incorporated into all kinds of ritual occasions as a female exemplar of Buddhahood. Even though technically speaking, from the Theravada perspective, you can't have two Buddhas simultaneously. So the Theravada text would not call her a Buddha, but in conveying, you know, her as equivalent to her son and able to do all the things that her son did, maybe even better, the idea is conveyed that she is a Buddha. And so contemporary practitioners are saying, she is a Buddha. And we'll show her, we'll show that to be the case. That's my sense of it. Yeah.
But the image, she has images, just not the death.
Images of her seeking ordination. Yes, back in the back. I think I've become much more convinced by that scholarship than I was initially. I do think that the Theravada texts are careful in their labeling of her, and so I don't go so far as to describe her as a female Buddha, as some do. But I do think that the role that she plays is quite extraordinary. And there's probably many more texts that I don't know about that I'll learn about as I continue researching her. So yeah, I think she is a feminist icon. At the same time, there are those aspects of her portrayal that that depict her in ways that seem limiting. But that's possibly the case with all of the members of the Buddha's family. The Buddha himself is often shown to be aware of his familial situation. That's why I refer to the milk debt situation, because if Reiko Onoma is right, the Buddha may have said yes to his mother against his own better judgment simply because she was his mother. And so her, you know, the fact that he is her son is what was really foremost in his mind. So he is family line too. And that's what I think is interesting to think through. Yeah.
When you refer to where the texts, some of the texts play down the importance of the milk debt, the interpretation you mentioned of that is downplaying the importance of motherhood. But in the context you discuss, is it possible, of course I haven't read the sources, but is it possible that this is actually a counter to the idea that she was only accepted because of the milk debt? But this is instead a voice that's trying to say, no, she was accepted because ultimately because the Buddha knew she could have these attainments.
Could accomplish. Yes, if what she's saying in the text is, you didn't have to take me on as a nun because you owed me anything. You had to take me on because you recognize my potential for accomplishment. That would clearly be what the text is saying. It's so hard to tell because the text is actually being very deferential and apologetic. You know, she's approaching him. She's about to say, please allow me to go forth and for complete nirvana. Oh, and by the way, I'm sorry that I maybe gave you a hard time when I asked to become a nun. I know I really bothered you by asking three times. So there's a lot of sort of deferential language there. So it's hard for me to tell from this particular text. But it's a very good question, because I think that's just the question that we're pursuing as scholars, is what are the motives behind people's actions? What are the texts trying to tell us about these motives? And that milk debt question is key. Yes?
I'm not familiar with the eight special vows that she was asked to, that all of the kings are asked to make. But I'd also like to know, in addition to what they are, how they were, why they were chosen to be given to all of the kings.
How the eight vows were chosen?
Yes, the eight vows are, and how they were selected.
Well, my sense, I am convinced by the arguments that Alex Bonberg makes, that these eight special rules, special additional rules, were after the fact created by Buddhist, fretful Buddhist authors who were nervous about the image of women who were living independently. So I agree with Swanberg that these eight special rules were composed later. And the sort of gist of all of them is that women should not operate autonomously. So, for example, when it comes to scheduling, the monks can schedule their various meetings on their own, but the women have to confer with the monks as far as scheduling. Penances, same thing. Various occasions where the Sangha meets together, then it's always the women who have to have sort of male supervision, whereas the Bhikkhu Sangha can operate independently. Ordination, and that's been an interesting issue for contemporary nuns, because monks have to be, according to the eight special rules, monks have to be involved before you can ordain a nun. And that's not the case with monks ordaining monks.
Was she ordained in a similar way to the way the nuns were ordained now? Was there ordination?
Well, in earlier texts, the Buddha is reported to just say, hey, bhikkhu, come along, and much more informal. Hey, bhikkhuni, come along. So you don't find the same sort of elaboration of rituals. Again, a lot of those things are after the fact, literary developments.
So to kind of really contextualize what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a great next step for me, to look at a variety of sources outside the narrow Buddhist canonical set. And I'm sure they're out there. It's really just a matter of seeking that cultural context. So thank you, that's very helpful.
One more. I'm so fascinated. You mentioned so many little things in passing, but to me, it's like, so this auto cremation.
Great term, isn't it?
Also, this is a term by Dr. James Benn about self immolation, but not by setting up wood, lighting yourself on fire, actually from the
spontaneous combustion.
So this Subhadra. Where he performed this in your, this may be off central topic, but in your reading, is this quite common? Can you say more?
Many of the saints who, arhats is the term that is used in many of the Theravada texts. And it's a very standard way of passing from this world, achieving final nirvana, levitating up in the air the height of 7 palm trees, and then exploding into flames. That seems to be the pattern. So I believe that reference in the Tibetan text to 18,000 arhats, or it might have been Pratyeka Buddhas, actually. Yeah, I think it's Pratyeka Buddhas. They explode into flames, auto-cremate. That's a very common mode of passing.
Because in China, I can only find one case. Everyone else has to kind of gather firewood and start putting oil, drink oil, to
right.
kind of put it. Whereas there's only one case where I found that this person just set himself a flame
right.
from his saliva.
Right.
So,
the trope, I think, is really strong in India. I've read accounts of women who are about to become satis, who have such radiance, their bodies are so radiant or shakti, that their finger lights on fire. And that whole idea of tapas or radiance in India goes way, way, way back. So may just be the Indic cultural context. Or maybe people really did spontaneously combust. Who can say?
If you have any more questions, we're going to move the party out into the lobby where there is a wonderful reception set up for us. And I wanted to thank Susan Stetson for setting up the reception, as well as students Brent, Koya, Lori, whoever else helped, I'm not sure. Thank you very much. Let's move out here. Let's have some refreshments and continue the conversation.